businesses that are here in Humboldt County. And I'm going to show you data on a number of specific survey questions about various beliefs and attitudes that people have. But first, I want to show you the understanding, the underlying dynamics, that beliefs about climate change, support for mitigation and adaptation policies, actions to reduce your own carbon footprint or to activist activities, they go straight down from the alarmed, the dismissive. But there is this second pattern, issue involvement, and that is how much you care about the issue. And it shows it's a very different pattern, so that the dismissive care about this issue about as much as the concerned do. The people there in the middle, particularly the disengaged, but also the cautious and the doubtful, care about this issue very little. And this has big implications in terms of how we communicate with them. And I'm going to talk to you more about that as we go through this talk. So there are five beliefs that are key to getting people to engage with the issue of climate change. There is research showing that five beliefs are strongly related to supporting policies to reduce climate change, to engage in consumer activism and political activism. And those beliefs are being certain that climate change is happening, the Earth is warming. Second is understanding that it is humans who are causing climate change. It's unlikely that we would be able to reduce it if we weren't the ones who were causing it by the actions that we're taking. Third is that there is a scientific consensus on it. This little poster here on the left is from a scientist who was attending the American Geophysical Union annual conference in San Francisco, and there was an actual demonstration among scientists, and this was her poster, along with citations supporting each of the points that are there on the sheet. The fourth point here is that climate change is harmful, and it's specifically important that we talk about its harm to humans, and I will talk more about that later and why that's important. And the fifth, which is extremely important, is that there's hope that we actually can do something, because if we can't do anything about it, if there's nothing that can be done to stop this or reduce the kind of climate change we're facing, then let's go see what's on TV. That just fosters avoidance. So let's look at where we are in Humboldt County. These are data from the spring of 2019 about where we are in Humboldt County on these beliefs, as well as one other that we'll talk about here in a second. First of all, we've got 3/4 of the people here who recognize that climate change is happening. There's still 12% of the population who say it's not happening, and another 13% who say that they don't know if it's happening or not. So 3/4 recognize that it's happening, but there's still ways to go there. In terms of cause, that human activities are causing climate change, this is much more problematic. There are a lot of folks who will tell you it is hubris to think that humans can change the climate. God controls the climate. Humans can't possibly control the climate. And that is a barrier for us in terms of engaging people that they don't recognize that. And this is an important thing for people to understand. If we are going to get them to support policies to reduce carbon emissions. This third one that most scientists think global warming is happening. The scientific consensus on climate change is very strong, like 97% plus of climate scientists say it's real and human caused. Scientists are more certain that climate change is happening than they are that smoking causes cancer. I think that's a surprising and interesting fact. But there is still, thanks to disinformation campaigns from the fossil fuel industry and think tanks associated with the fossil fuel industry, there's disinformation out there that there's a lot of confusion about climate change and why should we take any action on it as long as the scientists aren't sure. So notice here that all we're asking is whether most scientists think it's happening, and we get just under two-thirds of Americans who recognize that that is the case. When we ask them to actually estimate the proportion of climate scientists who recognize that climate change is happening, very, very few, less than 10%, recognize the level of scientific consensus that there is on climate change. And then the fourth item on this page, global warming is affecting the weather. This wasn't on the last slide that I showed you with the key beliefs, but this is an important one here because we know for people like us who are the alarmed and for the dismissive at the other end of the spectrum, what we already believe about the issue shapes how we interpret the weather. So every time the temperature is high, I think here it is. There you see, you know, climate change is happening. Similarly, at the other end of the spectrum, when it snows, Senator Inhofe takes a snowball onto the Senate floor and says, see, there's snow. Oh, how can there be global warming? But those people in the middle segments, when they understand that there is a connection between climate change and the local weather, it is a powerful tool in helping them to connect with the issue and become engaged with the issue. More and more we're seeing weathercasters who are talking about the links. And you see here in California also that, you know, the fires that we have, there are links, not nearly as many as there should be, but still you will see articles that talk about, or hear news that talks about climate change is making these fires worse. In terms of how bad it is, you can see at the top there that two-thirds of the people here in Humboldt County are worried about climate change. In terms of how much harm climate change will happen, we ask about a whole range of different types of harm, harm to who and when. And what you see is that there is a straight decrease, pretty much, from the more distant the object of harm is, other species, future generations, people in developing countries. They're pretty far from me, and I recognize they're going to be harmed. But me personally, I'm not so likely to think that I'm going to be harmed. People, if we start to get closer, people in the U.S., well, yes, they're being harmed. If you go to people in my community, it goes down step by step the closer that you get to me. And we are much more likely to get people to take action on climate change and become engaged with the issue when they recognize that they and their loved ones are at risk, when the risk comes home, instead of being to polar bears or people in developing countries or future generations. This is one of the things, well, I'm jumping ahead here, but this is one of the things that we as environmentalists tend to think, those are really important and those really motivate me to get active. But those people in the middle segments, the cautious and the disengaged, that is not so effective in engaging them as it is in reaching us. And so it's good for us to try to look at, to talk about harm that is closer to home. I don't have any data for Humboldt County on optimism about being able to reduce climate change, but given that we're pretty close to the national averages, I think this is worth sharing. we ask people which of the following comes closest to your view, and these are possible outcomes. Up there at the top, you can see the response, humans can reduce global warming and we're going to do so successfully. Only 5% of people, of Americans, agree with that statement. You get 7% who say it's not happening, 15% who say we can't reduce it even if it is happening. A quarter of people say we could reduce global warming, but people aren't willing to change their behavior, so we're not going to. And that's very sad, and not without reason that people feel that way. But by far, the most common response is that we could reduce global warming, but it's unclear at this point whether we'll do what's necessary. And that's actually good, you know, that's a motivator. Okay, so we could do something, but we need to do something. I think that can be a motivator to help people become more engaged and actually do something, get involved. In terms of policy support, we have here a whole list of policies aimed at reducing climate change, at mitigating climate change, and then two at the bottom that are the drill, baby, drill policies, drill for oil in the Arctic or expand offshore drilling. And you can see that for all of the policies that are related to mitigating climate change, you have very strong support for those policies here in Humboldt County, over 80% on funding research into renewable energy and providing tax rebates, the lowest being requiring utilities to produce 20% of electricity from renewable sources. And I find it surprising we even get 70% of the Humboldt population supporting the idea of requiring fossil fuel companies to pay a carbon tax. I can see that it would be possible for the fossil fuel companies to reduce that level of support by talking about how much it's going to increase gas prices. But in the abstract, people are supportive of that idea here. And then the final bit of Humboldt County data that I want to share with you are these two items, because generally the media inform us about issues and it's people communicating with other people who change hearts and minds. But you have to hear about it in order to become engaged. And what we see here, hear about global warming in the media at least once a week, we have 59% of people here say they hear about it once a month or less often in the media. So they're not seeing information about it. And you see that 57% rarely or never talk about the issue. One of the most important and effective things that we can do to build citizen engagement is to talk to each other about it. And people are not talking about it. So that's some place that we want to focus. So I want to stop there for a second and see if any of you have questions so far.
So Connie, I'm going to start with a question from John Anderson. I'm so glad you asked this, John. Connie, do you have data for other counties or for California as a whole?
Yes. These data come from an organization called the Climate Advocacy Lab, which is an online collaboration between social scientists and climate activists. They have a wealth of resources there that are open for anyone to use. If you Google the Climate Advocacy Lab, you will find them. And there are the Yale opinion maps on the site. They don't have all of the data that I've just shown you, but some of it you have to become a member in order to get access to. But most of what I showed you is openly available to you there. And they have at Yale just they've got some brilliant stats students who figured out how to take the national data and aggregate it and then downscale it to counties. So all of the counties are there in the whole country, as well as the states, as well as the nation as a whole. And if you become a member, I think you have to be a member for this, they have media markets as well. So yes, lots of data there, and it's really a great resource to check out.
Thanks. So we have another question from Dan. So Dan asks how we can get more people in Humboldt County to recognize the consensus of scientists about global warming, and also to realize that there's going to be a big impact in Humboldt County with sea level rise.
Let's reserve that as I talk about actually communicating, because I will come, you know, I have a bunch of things to say in response to that, Dan, and we will talk about that, and then you can ask me more specific, like, but what about?
Thanks, Connie. Those are the only questions that we have so far.
Okay. All right. So let's go on to the second question here about how audiences.
I had a question.
Oh, please.
I'd like for you to explain the anthropogenic heat engine effect. You know, we have, as I understand it, we have a reflective layer in the atmosphere, and then some of the greenhouse gases are trapped, and then there is heat emanating from the, you know, below our feet in the core of the Earth, and then there's anthropogenic heat, you know, the whole heat engine. And could you explain the balance, you know, the fluxes of heat? Because it seems to me that the amount of anthropogenic heat, especially from cities, is enough to really throw things out of whack. And I think it would be important for us to understand at this point just how much would we have to reduce our energy expenditures in order to have a livable future.
I'm not sure who is asking this question, so I don't know your name. But
oh, Jesse Noel.
Oh, okay. Well, Jesse, I'm not a climate scientist. I'm a social scientist. And I can't really answer the questions about climate science. I'm not competent in that area at all. But there are a number of great resources online where you can go and you will find the answers to that. The first one I would send you to is the National Climate Assessment, which is a collaboration among a bunch of different federal agencies. And they have great information there that can answer the kind of question that you're asking. But I'm not the person to ask that. I study
thank you.
Rather than climate. Sorry.
Great. And just going forward, if you can enter your question into the chat, that would be great.
Okay, so now we're going to talk about how audiences differ in the ways that they respond to information and how they use it. And this is the most common fallacy about communicating with other people, and particularly in information campaigns and persuasion campaigns. It's called the information deficit model, and it makes so much sense. So we know a lot about climate change. And we're just going to share that information with people, and they'll learn it, and their attitudes will change, and their behaviors will change. We have now 75 years of data showing that that fails over and over again. And it's hard for us to get the lesson that it fails, because it just makes so much sense. That is the way things should work. And it does work with a segment of the population, but overall it doesn't work. it doesn't work for a number of reasons relating to motivations and ability and the social environment. First of all, motivations. I'm not interested in this. I don't want to hear about it. Second, I've made up, selective exposure is I've made up my mind about this issue, and I am not going to pay attention to what you are trying to say. I am going to go to sources that reinforce what I already believe. We selectively expose ourselves to information that is consistent with what we already think, and that was less of a problem when there were three television networks than it is today when we have so many channels of information. People really do live in their bubbles and don't get exposed to information with opposing points of view. And then third, motivated reasoning. That we have lots of evidence that if I agree, I already agree with what you're saying, I accept it uncritically. If I disagree with what you're saying and I want to be able to reject it, I will distort the information, I will, come up with arguments against it, critically analyze it, not necessarily correctly, but I will find a way, because I'm motivated to reject your argument, I will find a way in order to do so. Ability is just being able to understand information on climate change, which I'm going to show you in a sec is really an issue. And then social norms. If everyone in my group is a climate skeptic, I don't care what you say. If all the people around me think it's a hoax, I'm going to think that way too. I'm going to be very resistant to changing that perspective because it's not consistent with what my social group believes. These are data that illustrate the role of ability and motivation. This is the proportion who agree with these two statements. I have difficulty understanding news reports about global warming. 3/4 of the disengaged agree with that statement. But even if you look at the alarmed, 1/4 of us say we have a hard time understanding it. The people who obviously understand this the best are the dismissive. Only 19% of them say that they have a hard time understanding it, and the rest of them understand it very well. There's a cognitive scientist, John Miller, who does research on science literacy, and he finds that only about 20% of the U.S. population can read and understand a news article, a science news article in the New York Times. That's 1 out of 5. So, ability is a barrier to reaching people. Then this second, in general, I don't like to read or hear anything about global warming. We have majorities of 3 of our audience segments saying, yeah, I don't want to hear about this. For some of them, it's because I don't care about it, but it's disengaged. And for the dismissive, it's really because I so disagree with it. But again, even among the alarmed, you see 10% of them say that they don't want to hear about it. So motivation is another barrier. Now I want to take you to this figure again, issue involvement, which is this curvilinear shape here, and show you how that shows up in survey data, and in terms of understanding how people who are in those middle segments are thinking and feeling. When we ask people, how much have you thought about global warming before today, you see that shape that you just saw in the last picture, that the alarmed have thought about it a lot. The concerned and dismissive, some. The other 3 segments, only a little or not at all. And, you know, I often think that these proportions here, the averages that I'm showing you here, are inflated because I don't want to admit on a survey that I never think about this at all. So I'll say, well, I pay attention a little bit. I think about it a little bit. But there's the pattern. And then if you look at the figure on the right, that's how that translates into attitudes about climate change, how firmly I have my opinion is formed on the issue. And you see that with the cautious and disengaged, majorities agree that they could easily change their minds about the issue. It's like in advertising for products, brands where there isn't much differentiation between one brand and another, they repeat the ad, repeat the ad, repeat the ad in the hopes that the name of the product will just be stored enough in memory so that when you walk down the grocery aisle and you see that name, that's the one you'll pick up. What happens with the cautious and the disengaged? They're inclined to think it's happening, but they're not really sure at all. And when they come in contact with skeptic arguments, they're likely to agree with those, but they'll forget it. They come in contact with with some science information, they agree with that and they forget it. They don't form strong opinions, and that's the barrier we need to address to get them to recognize that this is something that they should care about and to form real opinions, which they don't currently have. So I want to talk in the third section about what we actually do about all of this, but let me see if you have any questions about that segment.
So we have no new questions in the chat.
Great. I'm happy to go on. The third question then is how we that understanding of your audience informs both what you try to achieve and how you try to achieve it. And I want to show you here what information people are looking for. We know this based on surveys where we ask them. So if you could talk to a climate expert, what would you like to ask? And overwhelmingly, the people who are in the alarmed and concerned segments want to hear about solutions to climate change. We don't want to scare those people. They are scared enough already. I'm guessing many of you on this call despair. I know I find despair. And what we want, what those people need is information that gives them hope that can motivate them to act. The middle segment doesn't know why they should care about it. They don't understand the threat. Each step that you take away from, you know, in the sequence from the alarm to the dismissive, each step away from the alarm that you move, people perceive the threat as less and less imminent, as having less relevance for me personally. And we do need to talk to them about why they need to care because, gee, we're going to have a lot more of these fires and it's going to get worse and worse unless we do something about this. But when we talk to them about that, we also need to be presenting them with information on solutions because if it's too scary, it backfires. And then third, with the doubtful and dismissive, as much as possible, we don't want to talk about climate change, but it is good to talk about the co-benefits of climate change. So we know from experimental research that conservatives respond well to messaging about the health benefits of reducing, say, carbon emissions from gasoline-powered vehicles. We're driving electric cars, we have less pollution in the cities, rates of asthma go down. Those kinds of health benefits are effective in reaching them. It also makes sense that energy independence and national security should be co-benefits of action on climate change that will speak to conservatives However, I don't have solid experimental evidence showing that yet. This is a young field and we just don't know for sure. But in terms of conservative solutions to climate change, we do have ample evidence showing that when that part of the reason that conservatives are more likely to say that climate change is a hoax or it isn't real or it isn't caused by humans is because they believe that the solutions to climate change involve government regulation, which they oppose across the board. And I know this doesn't make sense, but if a problem has a solution that I don't like, I am more likely to say the problem isn't real. And when there's experimental evidence showing that when you present conservatives with free market solutions to climate change, like removing fossil fuel subsidies so that all energy sources are on a level playing field, and if that's the way you can solve climate change, they become much less resistant to the idea that climate change is real. So those are the kinds of types of information we want to share with those different audiences. In terms of their attention and how they're likely to process information, the alarmed and concerned are paying attention, and that knowledge deficit model that I showed you at the beginning of the prior section, or this section, is applicable here. They will read information. It doesn't have to be video or just like radio. They'll read information. They will pay attention to it. And this is our secret weapon, one of our most important tools, is that we share information with the alarmed and the concerned, but especially the alarmed, and then we ask them to talk to their friends and family about it. And that's really, they act as opinion leaders and they share information. We can use the information deficit model with them. The middle segments are ignoring information. And so we need communication strategies that grab them. And when I talk about here in a minute, strategies to engage audiences, these are the people that I'm really talking about, because they're not paying attention, and we need to use communication strategies that they will be less likely to ignore. And finally, then, the doubtful and dismissive are counter-arguing everything that we are likely to say about climate change. So again, we don't want to get in an argument with them. We are not going to win those arguments. So that's not the way to go about it, but rather talking about co-benefits, conservative solutions, not whether climate change is real and human caused. So now let's go through some communication strategies. First of all, when you start talking to someone about climate change, when you want to start a conversation, you do not begin with what you want to communicate. You start by asking what the other person thinks about it. And these little drawings that I have here are from the Alliance for Climate Education, which is a wonderful program that goes into high schools and presents does presentations for teens and has been active in building teen activism. I've put the link here for this video. It's a 4-minute video. I would encourage you to take a screenshot of this so that you can go and watch the video afterwards. It's 4 minutes of time well spent. But the bottom line here is that you listen before you speak, so that you find out roughly where the person that you're talking to is among those 6 audiences. And that tells you then a lot about what you can share with them. In terms of what you actually do share, let's go next and talk about that. First of all, Did you jump when you saw this picture? Just a little? Did it take you any time at all to process what that was? It's instantaneous, right? As soon as you see the picture of the bear, you, oh, yeah, I know that. I know what that is. Contrast that with what it takes in order to process this. We in climate communication rely way too much on material that looks like this second figure. It takes systematic processing to understand what's here. It takes a lot of work. Whereas the bear, you instantly recognize. And I'm not saying we want to terrify people, but it just is such an instantaneous response. That's what we want to engage. These are different ways that brains process information. And to as great an extent as possible, we want to minimize the use of content that requires the kind of systematic processing you would have to engage in to understand this horrible figure, and instead rely on content that is more easily, instantly understood. So I went two slides. Let's go back. So visual imagery like the glaciers receding, that's something that people understand automatically without having to see any data on the amount of decline, the percent that they have decreased, and how that correlates with rise in carbon emissions and those sorts of things. In terms of other content that uses visual imagery, we environmentalists tend to go for the iconic species. We love our polar bears. I love our polar bears. I'm betting everybody else on this call does too. But think about the single mom in the disengaged group who is wondering if she can pay her rent. She's been laid off because of COVID. She has kids who need to go to school, and what is she going to do right now about school? That woman, and there are so many people like this, yes, that's really sad about the polar bears, but I have these problems that are so much closer to home and so much more immediate to me. And the polar bears are not immediate enough in order to engage those people who are in the middle segments. And that's who we're aiming to reach. The same goes for people in distant countries, I've never been out of the U.S., and I don't really have an empathic connection to people who are in East Africa. That looks really sad, but I have concerns here at home, and I don't have space in my life to worry about what's going on in East Africa when I don't know if I'm going to be able to pay my rent. So instead, if we are talking about the harm that climate change causes, we want to bring it as close to home as possible. These are pictures from the fire in Santa Rosa a couple years ago. And this is a lot more real for people here in our area. This is the kind of harm that is going to make it feel more personally relevant to the people in the middle segments who we want to reach and engage. Dan, I remember we talked about this article. I want to strongly recommend that you not terrify people. We know that if people become really frightened, they will engage in the kinds of cognitive strategies people use to, it's too scary. So I'm going to discount the threat. I'm going to forget the threat. I'm going to distort what you say about it. I'm going to claim that you are exaggerating. Terrifying people is counterproductive We want them to understand the threat without becoming terrified. Here's a wonderful example of communicating threat in a way that does not, that is not so frightening. This is from a really great campaign that was on the buses and in the subways in Boston, called Wicked Smart. And it was a series of posters that appeared on the buses over the course of a year, and they all used ostriches. The dumb ostrich often is presenting a point of view that is a climate skeptic argument, whereas the ostrich with the glasses, it will be the smart one who presents the climate science. And notice it's funny, you know, and we know from the evaluation, people loved these. And you can get the information across without terrifying people. And at the same time, you want to provide people with solutions that preferably concrete, effective actions that they personally can undertake, like riding a bike. That is going to increase acceptance that the threat is real and motivate people to take action. So this campaign started with talking about climate science, damage to Boston, and then solutions. There is a second part to this that is important, and notice, look for Boston's climate leaders. This is praising people who are organizations and individuals who are taking action, showing them to be admirable for it, and that plays into the social norms. What we want is positive new social norms around green behaviors. I love this cartoon, but we don't, you know, this kind of thinking, oh God, here they come, act green, is not something that happens so much consciously as it does at an unconscious level. We're not very aware of social influences that's happening. This is what we want to have happen, that people come to accept as the norm and or as the admired behavior, the green behavior. There's a lot of experimental evidence showing that that is effective in getting people to change when they believe that other people that they care about will admire them and like them if they are taking green actions. That is a very effective way to motivate people to act. One thing about social norms that we want to avoid to as great an extent as possible is talking about how prevalent harmful behaviors are. That when we talk about, there are this many cars being driven in California and they are emitting this many tons of carbon emissions every year, and isn't that terrible? What that tells the audience is that the norm is to drive and to feel bad about driving, but to drive. Instead, we just want to talk about what's the right thing to do rather than how many people are doing the wrong thing, the behavior that we want to change. And if I had more time, I would tell you about this brilliant study that was inspired by the Park Service having at the Petrified Forest this message about your heritage is being vandalized by theft losses of 14 tons a year. And when they changed the message to not talk about how much was being stolen, but simply said, don't steal the rocks, you saw a large decrease in the number of people who stole rocks from the park. Stories are one of the best ways to engage your audience. You can use your own story. That's one of the interpersonal conversations that the Alliance for Climate Education video talks about. Your own story about how you became engaged, or a story like this one. These are people who live in the Alaskan village Shishmaref, where they are facing erosion. They are facing the entire community having to move because of sea level rise is destroying their island. Those kinds of stories engage people in a way that charts and figures never will. Asking questions and surprising the audience is a great way to generate interest and reach across, particularly with those middle segments. This is from the Wicked Smart campaign in Boston, communicating about the consensus on climate change. And the first poster, "Do climate scientists agree that people are causing climate change?" People had to wait a month before they saw the answer. That question was in front of them for a while before they got to know what the answer to the question was. That's a really lovely example of using questions with surprising information. I want to show you an example that really appealed to me the first time I saw it. This is the Easter Day Parade in New York City in 1900. Notice all the horses. At this time, waste from the horses all over the streets was a terrible problem in the city and in cities generally, that they just made a lot of waste on the streets. This is the same Easter Day Parade 13 years later. There is not a horse in sight. The problem was solved. We didn't know at the time that we were creating a different problem, but it just demonstrates how quickly change can happen when the community is really motivated to change. So I think that's a wonderful example of surprise that can be used in a way that builds hope. Katie, I realize it's now 8 o'clock. And I am happy to talk about what's next. I'm also happy to stop and take questions. This last section is about communicating with conservatives. And I'm happy to talk about this. I'm also happy to stop here, whatever people would like.
I think if you're willing to keep going, this is great. I mean, if folks want to drop off, that's also fine. We are recording this, so you can access it later. I think it's really up to you, Connie.
Okay. I'm happy to go on. This actually is the last section. And there's a reason that I saved it for last. There's a body of research, if you're interested in this, that's a really wonderful book by the psychologist Jonathan Haidt. It's Haidt, called The Righteous Mind, that looks at the differences in values between conservatives and liberals. What core values motivate us? And we environmentalists tend to be liberal and tend to hold a certain set of values that conservatives also hold to some extent, but not as strongly as we do, and they hold other values that we are not likely to hold. And the reason I kept this for last is it's hard for us to honestly communicate from within these framings of climate change. And I would never recommend that you lie or pretend, you know, to feel certain ways that you do. Uh, pretend that you feel other than you do in order to try to convince someone. That's going to backfire. Nonetheless, to the extent that you can relate to these frames, these are effective frames for reaching conservatives. First, that conservation is patriotic and that polluting destroys the purity of the environment and violates its sanctity. If you read any part of the Pope's encyclical on the environment and climate change, you'll see that's very strong within that encyclical. And third, that conservation demonstrates in-group loyalty and respect for authority. That this particular study, Red, White, and Blue Enough to Be Green, has the best title of a journal article I think I've ever seen. I love this title. And in the experiment, the authors showed liberals and conservatives these different messages accompanied by visual elements, photos of a bald eagle in front of a mountain peak and a flag in front of a distant mountain. And all of those three frames I just showed you on the prior slide are here in the text. Show you love your country by joining the fight to protect the purity of America's natural environment. Take pride in the American tradition of performing one's civic duty by taking responsibility for yourself and the land you call home, by taking a tougher stance on protecting the natural environment, you will be honoring all of creation. Demonstrate your respect by following the examples of your religious and political leaders who defend America's natural environment. Show your patriotism. So there was that message, and then there was the liberal frame that emphasizes harm, care, fairness, justice. And here we have photos of a woman cradling a seedling and children watering a newly planted tree. And the text, show your love for all of humanity and the world in which we live by helping to care for our vulnerable natural environment. By caring for the natural world, you're helping to ensure that everyone around the world gets to enjoy fair access to a sustainable environment. Do the right thing by preventing the suffering of all life forms and making sure that no one is denied their right to a healthy planet. Show your compassion. Now, the attitudes toward climate change that were measured after people saw these messages, for the liberals, it didn't matter which of these messages they saw. They accepted climate science and expressed high intentions to act in environmentally friendly ways. They accepted the climate science and were concerned about it. For the conservatives, if they saw this message, they reacted very negatively to it. If they saw the conservative message, let's go back to that, their attitudes toward climate change did not differ from the liberals. This was effective, at least in the short term, this was effective in influencing them to accept climate science and be supportive of action to reduce climate change. I can't honestly communicate this myself. If you can take this kind of a perspective, if it comes from your heart that you hold these values, this is going to be an effective communication, type of communication with conservative audiences. So just the list of these things that I've talked to you about, just a refresher here to close up. So to start a conversation about climate change, begin by asking what the other person thinks about it and then meet them where they are. Minimize the use of content that requires systematic processing. We want content that can be instantly processed. Bring the threat close to home and focus on human impacts, not the threat to other species. Don't terrify people. This backfires. Instead, pair information about the threat with information about feasible and effective solutions. Something I wish I'd included in here is use humor where you can, and pay close attention to who the sources are. For those middle segments, you want people that are likable, attractive, that they trust as your sources of information to as much, to as great as an extent as possible. Use stories. Humans love stories. And if you have characters that your audience can identify with, that builds emotional involvement with the issue. Next, we want to think about building positive new social norms, that people who are engaging in behaviors that reduce their footprints, that's admirable. People like them. People think they're cool. All the cool folks, this is what they're doing now. Don't talk about how prevalent harmful behaviors are. Just go right past that to what you actually want people to be doing. If you can ask questions, that creates interest and suspense, that engages people, it builds involvement in a way that simply presenting, simply saying 97% of climate scientists agree that human-caused global warming is happening is much deader than saying, how many climate scientists think climate change is happening and caused by humans? And then people want to make a guess. They want to, and then they want to see if they're right. You can surprise the audience if you're able with information they don't expect. And then we want to try to think about if we can frame messages in ways that, for conservatives that are consistent with, that speak to their values, that are consistent with their values. So that's all I have for you. This is all of this that I've presented to you is a collaboration between a lot of people, including all of the people who are listed here, plus postdocs and students. We started out just Ed Maybach, Tony Leiserwitz, and I in 2017, and we're a big group now. It's cool. But I'm happy to talk to anybody about any of your questions.
Well, Connie, don't you think that we're at a change right now? I mean, God, look at all the Teslas that are driving around and how many charging stations are just blossoming. You know, more people are buying EVs. I mean, I think it's really happening.
Things have gotten a lot better. Absolutely. That back in 2007 when we first started doing this, there was a lot of concern about climate change. And then a number of things happened, the recession, ClimateGate, the failure of the COP talks in Copenhagen, and concern about climate change just went way down in this country. The proportion of dismissives more than doubled in the space of 2 years. And then things very, very slowly started. It hardly changed for a long time until about 2015. Several things happened then. The Pope's encyclical, Obama's clean power plan. It was a really bad hurricane season. There was
fire.
Activism about drilling in the Arctic, and climate change was just a lot more in the news starting at that point. And since then, we've seen a pretty steady increase in concern about the issue in the U.S. The data that I showed you on the segments was even better back in November before COVID hit. Some concern, you know, people can only worry about so many things. Mm-hmm. And we see some decrease actually since what we where we were last November. Nonetheless, the issue is still much more on the agenda than it has ever been before, which is just great.
Thanks, Connie. We do have a question about the connection between wildfires and climate change. So do you, are you finding that that folks in sort of more conservative areas of California are making that connection between wildfires and climate?
You know, I would like to answer that. I think we have the data to answer that, but I have not looked at it. If the person who asked that question, Katie, if you get their contact information, I will do the runs and see what I can dig up that would be relevant to answering that question.
Okay, great. Thanks, Connie. So we have another question.
Hi, my name is Jesse Noel, and my question is, does your strategy on educating the public or outreaching change at the point where there is a high likelihood that things have gone too far and we're on an exponential overheating?
I hope I don't have to figure that out. We have not, as a team, ever discussed that. We just keep trying to give people hope. It's not too late. It's not too late. If we get to the point that you're talking about, then different strategy is called for, but I don't know at this point what that strategy would be. It would depend on what specifically we were facing. You know, what kind of government we had at that point, what kind of. It would depend a lot on what was actually going on in terms of international and national responses to the issue.
Thanks, Connie. I just want to say to everyone, we have a bunch of questions in the chat, so if you could enter your question in the chat, then I'll get to it in the order that it was received. So people can make sure that they can, you know, people who asked questions earlier can have their questions addressed. So we do have another question that kind of came up sort of halfway through your talk, I think. And it was about the connection between doubtful and dismissive folks and conservatism. So are people who are doubtful and dismissive, are they overwhelmingly conservative, or are there some, is there some nuance there?
Yes, they are overwhelmingly conservative. There are not strong demographic differences between the segments, but there are some. And the dismissive tend to be older white males. The doubtful tend to be older and white also. In terms of their views, the great difference between them is that the dismissive say it's just not happening, it's a hoax. The doubtful are open to the idea that it's happening, but they are very firm in their belief that humans can't be causing it. Both of those groups tend to be evangelical Christians. People who are in the disengaged segment tend to have the lowest socioeconomic status of the six segments, which makes perfect sense. You know, the example I gave you of not being able to pay the rent and you want me to worry about polar bears, explains why people in the disengaged are disengaged. Hispanics tend to be very much in the alarmed segment. There is high concern about climate change among Hispanic populations. And I believe that's true to some extent of Blacks also, but that has not been stable over the course of the surveys we've done. The proportion of Blacks in the different segments has kind of jumped around over time. It hasn't been as stable. Whereas with Hispanics, it's pretty consistently up there in the alarm, which makes sense given how many of them are engaged in outdoor agricultural work. They're living it. And how many of them live in the Southwest, you know?
Okay, thank you, Connie. So we have a question from Dan. This question is about the high percentage of folks in Humboldt who believe that climate change is real but don't understand the scientific consensus. So Dan asked if you have crosstabs for the Humboldt beliefs by the six types. And
they haven't downscaled that data to, I could create cross tabs of the recognition of the scientific consensus by segment at a national level, but I don't have the ability to do that for Humboldt County separate from the nation as a whole, or even for the state of California. I could only do it for the national data. If that would be helpful, Dan, I would be able to do that for you. It's interesting. Something we've talked about from time to time is that the proportion of people who think climate change is happening is higher than the proportion who believe that there's scientific agreement on it. So even though I don't think that all the scientists, I think the scientists are arguing about it, but I think it's happening. It's kind of a curious finding, but that.
That's interesting. So we have a question from John Anderson. John asks, how do we counter the idea that green behaviors belong to a privileged few?
Well, yeah, there are stereotypes, and the environmental, the big greens have historically been very white, and they are grappling with that now, and it's a wonderful thing to see, like the Sierra Club reckoning with its own history. John Muir was racist, and environmental justice groups are just growing by leaps and bounds in terms of the amount of attention that they are receiving and and how they are being integrated within the big green groups. So I think that the way we overcome that perception that it's all about white privilege, we're the rich guys who can do this, is by the kinds of things that the Sierra Club is doing. And in terms of, the actions that people can take, okay, so only a few people can afford to get solar panels on their houses. But the most effective actions that people can take are not expensive ones. And that is specifically contacting their legislators. That is the most important thing that you can do. Contact your legislators, write letters to the editor, talk to your neighbors and friends. All of those behaviors are free. And you don't have to be a rich white person to do them. And the literature on environmental policies shows that when environmental policies are passed by legislatures, it is in response to a combination of two factors. One is public opinion in favor of the policy, and the second is activism in support of the policy. So you have a broad support for it within the public, and you have some really loud people who are calling for it and making those telephone calls. So it's hard, John, but I think that's what I would say in response. Does that answer your question? Great.
So you have a bunch of people who are thanking you profusely. And then also we have a great question from Jacqueline, who asks, what sources and organizations do you recommend? And specifically organizations that work toward solutions.
Well, there isn't any organization that I wouldn't recommend. I like 350 a lot. I don't like the name of 350. I think that if I were Queen, I would change the name of 350 to something that people understand. But 350 is a great organization. I like the Sierra Club. I like the NRDC. I like the Environmental Defense Fund. The League of Conservation Voters. The Sunrise Movement. These are Fridays for Future. These are all great organizations, and I don't think you can go wrong.
Thanks. Okay, so we have a few more questions, if you're still willing.
I'm fine. I'm not going anywhere.
Okay, good. Thank you. So Richard asks what climate action success would look like. Would that mean sort of persuading lots of people to change their minds, or is there some other strategy?
I think what would look like success to me is national policy that reduces emissions fast enough to keep us within 1.5% centigrade increase in temperatures. I am not, just like I'm not a climate scientist, I'm not a policy wonk. I can't say this policy is the one that would do the job, but there are lots of people who are, who understand that a lot better than I do. One resource I'd recommend, looking for it up on my shelf, is Drawdown. Who is the editor of that? Here it is. Paul Hawken. I guess, can you see my, where am I? Get out of this. Can you see this book that I'm holding up? Drawdown by Paul Hawken, the most comprehensive plan ever proposed to reverse global warming. And this book is a great resource, and it ranks different kinds of actions that we can take to by how much they reduce carbon emissions. And if I were looking for solutions, this is where I would go first.
Great. I also put a link in the chat to this book and greater project. So tons of information there. So we have a question from Sue Lee Mossman. Sue Lee has a family.
Oh, hi.
So Sue Lee has a very right-wing family, apparently, but they're going green and buying solar panels, and she's puzzled. So how do you explain that?
Well, it happens, you know. I'm glad for her and glad for them that there are reasons. You know, there's an organization called Republic N, So it's with a capital E N at the end that is a conservative organization that promotes climate action. There are lots of conservative and increasing number of conservative leaders, not who tend to be in office right now, but people like Howard Schultz. That's the right name, isn't it? Howard? There are conservative leaders who recognize the problem and want action on it, who say we should be talking about the solutions rather than the reality. Stop fighting the science and instead accept the science and promote conservative solutions to climate change. And you know, if your family is going green in spite of being conservative, there are reasons, economic reasons for doing it, as well as climate reasons for doing it. And that might be their motivation, but I think that would be interesting to talk to them about. Have you talked to them about it?
Yes, some. And I believe it is the tax incentives and the financial incentives. And I also think that for some of them, are leaning towards being kind of like survivalist type people. And so that's making them independent of PG&E, not PG&E, but, you know, similar kinds of utility corporations.
Yeah, like in the South, the Green Tea Party.
Mm-hmm.
Don't tell me I can't put solar panels on my roof or, Good. Good for them.
So we can appeal to the conservatives, I think, by using those kinds of rationale, can't we?
Yep. Yeah, I didn't talk about that, but that's true.
That's a way of approaching the topic.
That there are economic incentives for being greener.
Mm-hmm. So in a similar vein, we have a question from Gail about people who believe in climate change, but don't seem to make a connection between their behavior and climate change.
What kind of behavior are we talking about? I mean, there are certain behaviors. Okay, so I'm really concerned about climate change, but I live 20 miles from where I work, and I don't have, there's no mass transit where I live. I gotta get in my car and drive. There are certain behaviors that are just constrained by our communities, the way our communities are designed. There are other behaviors that, there's a lot of misunderstanding out there about what actually reduces emissions and what doesn't. And that's a matter of public education, so that people come to understand what actually makes a difference.
I guess I was thinking about a lot of people, not right now, but, you know, who will go on vacations where they fly a couple times a year or don't seem to, like, go shopping at Costco or whatever and buy a lot of plastic-wrapped fruit or just drive all over the place, I guess. Those kinds of things that, you know, a lot of us have done. But, you know, they just don't seem to, there seems to be a disconnect there.
Yeah. All I can say to that is education. And and to the extent that we model green behaviors, we make it more likely that other people around us will engage in those behaviors as well. But there's not an easy answer to that. We have to make it easy for people to do the green thing. And right now it's easy to not do the green thing. It can be hard work. There's a metaphor of when you're trying to achieve change. There's the rider, which is your brain. There's the elephant, which is your emotional content, how you feel about things. And then there's the path. And to get the elephant to go down the path, the elephant won't go if the rider wants to go, but the elephant doesn't want to go. But even if the rider and the elephant want to get down that path, if there are obstacles in the path, that will stop the elephant as well. So we want to remove the obstacles from the path to as great an extent as we can.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay, so we have one last question. I think we're going to cut it off after that. But so this question comes from John Anderson. Who asks if there are opportunities for drawing analogies between COVID and climate change, and the specific example is listening to scientists and preparing for future threats.
Okay, repeat it one more time for me.
Oh, sorry.
I just want to make sure I got it all.
Yeah, so John asked if we can, you know, draw analogies or learn from COVID and apply what we've learned to climate change. Communication. So specifically, he brings up, if there are ways that we can sort of draw from the need to listen to scientists and prepare for future threats, you know, that we've learned from, you know, experiencing pandemic, and if we can take what we've learned from that and apply it to climate change.
That's funny. I saw a cartoon recently just a couple days ago that I posted on Facebook that showed two scientists standing outside an office door, and it said COVID over it. And one of them is saying to the other, if we just present the facts to the public, they'll understand and they'll respond. And right next door is another office door that says climate change above it. And there are two climate scientists there that are like rolling on the floor laughing. And when I put it on Facebook, I said, actually, those guys are crying, not laughing. Because the level of science denial in this country at this point is, it's terrifying, and it's very sad. It's very depressing. I don't think that we have seen anything so far with COVID that gives us good lessons we can use with climate change. Rather, the negative patterns that we've seen with climate change are being replicated in the country's response to COVID. I mean, the fact that a public health issue like this can be so polarized, and so much science denial going around, when the impacts of the virus are so plain, you know, with climate change, we can see the impacts now in front of us, but 15 years ago, we couldn't tell, not the average person. You needed to look at the data to be able to see the impacts of climate change. Now we can see it, but, Even when it's in front of our faces, that we've had 150,000 people die, and there's still people saying it's not real. I just find that so sad and dismaying, and I don't have an answer. I wish I did.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Connie, and I think we'll have to end on that. Things are dire, but there are solutions out there.
There are solutions out there. Yeah. And thank you all for coming. I'm so pleased that so many of you came. I'm really happy to talk to you. And if you want to get in touch with me and ask me anything personally, I am happy to talk to you about this.
Do you want to put your contact information in the chat?
Let's see if we can email. Oh, that said privately. That's not so. I need to do it. So to everyone.
I got that.
Oh, you got it? Okay.
I'll send it out to him.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. There's Connie's email, and then you can also email 350humble @gmail.com, and we'll put you in touch with her. And yeah, thanks to everyone who attended and participated. Again, we'll be having more of these talks in the future. And thanks again to EPIC and CRTP and 11th Hour and the Humboldt Unitarian Universalist Fellowship for co-sponsoring. And yeah, keep in touch and stay safe, everyone. Thanks, Connie.
Thank you all for coming. It was really a pleasure to talk to you. Bye-bye.